Tere kuulama Tasku Vikerkaart, mina olen Aro Velvet ja tänase saate külaliseks on Kanada ajaloolane Quinn Slobodian. Intervjuud Quinniga võite lugeda aprillikuisest Vikerkaarest ja selle teemaks on Ameerika välispoliitika ja selle uued suunad Trumpi teisel valitsemise ajal. Quinn, kuna ta on kanadalane, siis ta eesti keelt ei räägi. Ja seetõttu on see intervju, mida te kohe kuulete ka inglise keeles, aga kuna see teema on sedavõrd oluline ja mõjutab ka meie Eesti julgeoleku poliitikat, siis otsustasime selle siiski Ida Raadio eetrisse lasta. Nii et meeldivad kuulemist! My name is Aro Velmet, and today we are talking to Quinn Slobodian. Quinn is a professor of international history at Boston University and author most recently of Crack Up Capitalism, a book that we will be touching on a little bit today. Hi, Quinn.
Hi.
In a piece you wrote for the New York Review of Books, you argue that the insanity and seemingly wildly contradictory domestic politics of the U.S. right now come from, and I'm quoting here, the convergence of three strains of politics that have never simultaneously been this proximate to power. Those projects come from different but related places, the Wall Street, Silicon Valley nexus of distressed debt and startup culture, anti-New Deal conservative think tanks, and the extremely online world of anarcho-capitalism and right-wing accelerationism. So I'm convinced that this is true for domestic politics in the U.S. I wonder if we can apply the same analysis also to U.S. foreign policy, which seems, at least to me, at least as contradictory and flailing as domestic politics. Are we seeing a convergence of these different strains of politics in foreign policy as well? Or how do you analyze that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it plays out a little differently in foreign policy. I mean, there I would see the three strains as being one, neoconservatism, which is the most familiar form of American foreign policy thinking in the 21st century, which seeks to use some combination of American military dominance with a selective use of international organizations to get its way and intimidate and cow opponents and adversaries globally. So the approach that the United States had used in the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, and the way that they've been seeking to contain Iran and more recently Russia and China, has continued in certain ways. I think that the Signalgate debacle shows us in part that there's a faction of the cabinet who's still interested in just disciplining through exemplary actions of American bombing campaigns what they see as the insubordination of smaller powers, in this case the Houthi rebels in Yemen. So that there is, I think, a neocon undertone still with Michael Waltz and Marco Rubio in the central positions of foreign policy creation. But a second strain that is a bit more distinctive is what you could call paleoconservative. And that is, I think, better represented by J.D. Vance, who at least rhetorically wants to break entirely with a kind of 1990s model of neoconservatism that speaks the language of democracy promotion and that uses a mixture of hard and soft power to achieve its ends. Rather, he wants to break entirely with that and be much more realist and blunt about his lack of interest and America's lack of interest in soft power and human rights and democracy promotion, and based on the relationship to Zelensky in particular, so far seems to be happy with more of a sphere of influence style politics, which would just say that the United States dominates its hemisphere and other powers, whether they're Turkish, Chinese, or Russian, can have their own hinterlands to organize how they like. So, symptomatically in the Signalgate example, Vance was a bit annoyed that the United States was stepping in at all because he thought that this was Europe's problem. It was Europe's backyard and they should be the ones dealing with it. So that's already one fault line, I think, a kind of more isolationist is the byword that's used, but I don't think it's quite accurate because obviously the attempts to annex nearby countries, Canada, Greenland, Panama, is not exactly isolationist, but it is sphere of influence politics that is not very much like 20th century politics. It's more like 19th century politics. So I think you have those warring impulses. In a way, that's a old story in American foreign policy. The people who want to use globalism for their own ends and the people who are happy just doing American security policy through unilateralism. There is, though, again, a third part, the coalition, which is the same as the one that you just introduced with relation to domestic policy and Doge, which is the technological Silicon Valley faction, which has its own interests and which are being given more than their fair share of attention and influence right now. You can see in specific sectors like satellites, in desire to secure sources of rare earth, there are things connected to opening markets for digital services for tech giants that have become top of mind for foreign policy, whether that means leaning on European partners to open up space for Starlink satellites or to decrease content moderation on American provided tech platforms or to prioritize things that are needed for the supply chain of electric vehicles and smartphones and semiconductors. So that intersects with this too, I think. It's not just how should America exercise its power in the world, but it's also, how do you get that those raw materials for high-tech products, and then how do you force overseas markets to open themselves to become clients and customers of those core services from, Facebook and X to Starlink and SpaceX.
Yeah, I'm quite interested in the conflict between this last group, the Silicon Valley people, and then these first two groups, because I think it kind of illuminates a tension, or maybe not so much a tension, and I think we'll come to this between these two groups that have to do with sort of ideas about state power, right? Because the first two ones, and I am sort of quite sympathetic to this idea of spheres of influence politics rather than isolationist politics. Like with neoconservatives and paleoconservatives, one thing that sort of brings them together, though not without differences, is this kind of muscular attitude towards foreign policy. So, threatening to annex countries, using state power to get the things that they want, whether it's raw materials from Ukraine or whatnot. And then on the other hand, you have these Silicon Valley guys who, at least in the discourse, I think are sort of portrayed more as closer to something like libertarians, right? Some people who are interested in open international markets, in sort of mobile capital, the state getting out of the way of doing business. So there seems to be a, at least something resembling a tension there.
I mean, I would say that's an increasingly anachronistic way to talk about the politics of Silicon Valley, right? This is the whole point of Alexander Karp, the founder of Palantir, just had a number one New York Times bestseller called The Technological Republic. And the argument of that book is sort of exactly a rebuttal of what you're saying, in the sense that he says Silicon Valley for too long has been trying to keep itself at arm's length from the fray, and to not involve itself with the dirtier and more compromising parts of the national security state. And that's exactly what needs to be turned around now, that what characterizes this moment, and I think in a way it's an accurate portrait, characterizes this moment, is a willingness to plunge in headlong into being close partners with the national security state, both domestically and abroad. So I think any pretense of libertarianism is more or less been dropped by now. I think they're from Mark Andreessen's American Dynamism initiative, which he was pushing through the Biden years already, to now the very clear attempt to displace legacy partners like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon with new service providers and weapons manufacturers like Anduril and Palantir. They are not even speaking a rhetoric of anti-statism anymore. This is just, we are it. We are the new, as Biden called it in his outgoing statement, tech industrial complex. And that's what their whole portfolio is built on now. And the whole business model is attached to the assumption that they will be locked into federal contracts for some time to come, which is why I think even Musk, for example, can be a bit more blasé about losing, let's say, the consumer EV market. Not that he's been acting very blasé about the fall in share price and the protests at the dealerships, but there is a sense that if you can get those federal contracts more or less permanently secured, then, bye-bye libertarianism. I think that for me, the striking thing is that if you looked at the period of the two Obama administrations, and even all the way back to George W. Bush, there was a kind of a bifurcation in the way that global economic governance worked and global governance or global security strategy, where the US was quite willing to be unilateral and, in some cases, flout international law and flout the incentive to have partners at the national, at the international level in military and security matters. But there still was a more or less consensus around something like free trade globalism and free trade multilateralism. And what's really striking in this second Trump administration is how much that has been completely shredded. So now foreign economic policy is just part of foreign policy and is treated with the same level of arbitrariness and unilateralism as, the deployment of American military forces. So Trump now uses tariffs for leverage just as easily as he would have used military negotiations in the past. And that complete abandonment of free trade, global economic governance is something that has been brewing over the last few administrations, obviously, but I feel like we've reached a new level where the idea of exercising power through tariffs has become indistinguishable from the idea of exercising power through bombers.
Yeah, which seems to have ruffled a few feathers, right? The tariff policy, in particular, as well, really, as some parts of the immigration policy for the tech sector, because one argument you can make about the previous free trade or globalization economic policy is that it really was a policy that was working very well for the United States, and in some ways was a globalization of US IP laws around the world, which really just shored up the dominance of US tech sector, the biomed sector, all kinds of firms. So
Apparel, entertainment.
yeah, exactly. And it's not sort of clear what US corporations have to win from this flailing tariff policy
Well,
compared
no,
to this previous regime?
they're very worried. I mean, in that sense, I would actually separate out tariff policy and immigration policy, because I think the way that the immigration question is being handled now was arguably kind of priced in. And qualitatively and quantitatively, it's not a quantum leap from where Biden was or Obama was before him in terms of raw numbers. We don't know where that's going yet, but I think that the market jitters are not really about a fear of a vanishing workforce in the country yet. It's really just about these extraordinary tariffs, which are set to roll out in 2 days, that will be, double digit, up to 25% and above tariffs on some of the United States' biggest trading partners. And this is what is now leading to predictions of recession. So that trade uncertainty, I think, was assumed to be mostly being used as bluff and bluster. And now that it seems more likely to come into existence, the relationship between the investor class in this administration is really different from in the first administration, in that I was thinking about or following Arthur Laffer, who was one of the inspirations behind the Ronald Reagan supply side tax cuts in the early 1980s, who was also a close advisor of Trump in the first administration, is now ringing the fire alarm about the effect that the tariffs are going to have on the American economy. So things have taken a sharp turn away from what would be considered like a responsible stewardship of rising stock prices and keeping inflation under control, towards a kind of slightly reckless or adventurous policy of, fuck around and find out. Can't think of another way of putting it except that.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you worth saving, then you'd better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone, 'cause the times, they are a changing. Come writers, come critics, you who prophesy with your pen, keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who it is naming, for the loser now be later to win, 'cause the times, they are a changing. Come mothers, come fathers throughout the land, don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging, so please get out of the new one if you can't lend a hand, 'cause the times, they are a changing. Come senators, come congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he who gets hurt will be he who has stalled. There's a battle outside and it's raging. It'll soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. 'Cause the times, they are a-changing. The line it is drawn, the course it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing. For the times, they are a-changing.
Yeah, I wanted to come back to this this really striking level of comfort that the tech sector seems to have with the authoritarian turn in U.S. politics, mm-hmm. both domestically and and internationally. And a part of it, just seems to be that this is really not something new, and this is something that you've written about in the Crack Up Capitalism book, in this idea of the zone, which imagines this form of sovereignty that combines low or no regulation economics with sort of fairly authoritarian state power that enables that, that sort of restricts democracy in order for business to flourish. So, the example of Hong Kong or Dubai, and that these are regions where, in particular, the tech billionaires of the world have gotten quite accustomed to this mode of doing politics. So do you want to introduce that idea a little bit and why this has been so central to the fantasies of the tech sector for some time?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've been following in my work is to try to come up with a better intellectual genealogy of neoliberalism, and also then to ask what kind of institutions most reflect the animating spirit of something we could call neoliberalism. And if you take the baseline definition of neoliberalism to be the ongoing effort to protect capitalism from democracy, then capitalism has faced different threats at different moments in the 20th and 21st centuries. And at the beginning of the neoliberal project in the 1930s, when they first started talking about themselves that way, the nation was seemingly a disruptive factor. So there was collectivist efforts on the right in the form of fascism, and collectivist efforts on the left in the form of socialism and communism. After the Second World War, those turned into projects of social democracy, which were trying to, put regulation and certain brakes on the free movement of capital over borders with the Bretton Woods regime, which was designed to allow for both a welfare state and some level of free trade integration. So through that period, as I describe in my earlier book, Globalists, there was an effort to accommodate democracy, but also put sort of sharp constraints on it by imagining a set of multilateral institutions that would sit on top of nations and require nations to lock in certain rights beyond the control of lawmakers, basically. So
Yeah,
the
so this is the
European,
WTO, the
this
European
is the
Union.
European Economic Community, and then later the EU and the WTO, you had to agree that you wouldn't, give state aid to your corporations. You would have to allow national companies to compete with you. So there was a effort to tie the hands of lawmakers at a certain level because everyone agreed that this was the way to become most prosperous. And if you were a weaker nation, you just had to agree because this was the bargain that you were being offered. So that is what you could call globalism, neoliberal globalism in the 20th century, culminating in the 90s for sure. But at the same time, there were other people who thought, maybe we can better protect capitalism, not by accommodating democracy, but actually just exiting the big Leviathan of the welfare state and taking our investment and taking our profits and stashing them offshore somewhere beyond Europe, beyond North America. And the era of tax havens that really blew up in the 1970s and 80s was accompanied by an era of course, the outsourcing wave, where people are now setting up factories in small, cheaper places around the world. And when they set these things up, when they set up places to store taxes, they were often setting them up in things called special economic zones, which are jurisdictions inside of nations that have a different set of laws and a different set of tax codes that are more favorable to investors. So there was a way that there could be a battle to the bottom globally by manufacturers and companies seeking to avoid excessive corporate tax, shopping from zone to zone all over the world. And in that process, places like Hong Kong, as you mentioned, Singapore, Dubai, small, nimble states that had minimal or no democracy became the poster children or the paragons of what a new future kind of political arrangement could look like. And it became especially attractive to people from the tech sector, partially because of the nature of the work of software engineering or, writing code or coming up with new products. You didn't really need a large workforce the same way that someone like a Henry Ford needed, a big hinterland of towns to supply the bodies to build his cars. The model of tech in the 21st century was, captured when you pick up a new iPhone. It says designed in California, manufactured in China. You do the top end of the value chain stuff in one small place, and then you get some people somewhere else to put the thing together. So this fragmentation of sovereignty and this breakup of value and supply chains allowed for the fertilization of a different kind of political imagination too, that I think in sort of promoted this idea of being able to vote with your feet, vote with your dollars, and that there should be nations of consent rather than compulsion. So social contracts should be literal. Why can't you set up new areas and zones to which people can migrate with their money and opt in or opt out of this or that term and condition? And it remained kind of a fantasy or thought experiment to some extent. But what I describe in the book is places where they actually did manage to get this moving. And in Honduras is the prime example where there was one of these startup states that advanced quite far. And I think the way that the book works as an argument and the way it lands at the end is that someone like Peter Thiel, who is a arc theorist of this sort of a shattered sovereignty arrangement, goes from saying, hey, we need to exit politics and set up somewhere in the Caribbean, to by 2016 saying, wait, what if we just move into the American state itself, and occupying an existing state might actually be easier than starting a new one. And that is, I would say, the move that has characterized this first Trump or the second Trump presidency, is the co-optation really of much of the American federal government apparatus by a small number of tech founders and CEOs who are now figuring out how to use it for their own accumulation strategies and to reorient it for their own needs. Sometimes it's unbelievably blatant. So the one example is NASA, which has now a nominate the nominee for the head of NASA is a former SpaceX employee who shares Musk's belief that we need to deprioritize the moon and reprioritize Mars, which means setting aside many billions of dollars and many, many years of preparation for so-called Artemis project to set up a an orbiting space station around moon the moon to send down rovers to eventually set up a permanent settlement on the moon. This is now likely to be scrapped altogether simply because of the individual desires and, of course, corporate interests of one man. So it's pretty mind-boggling spectacle.
Yeah, just as an aside, I wanted to note that this ideology of shopping around for jurisdictions are favorable, and the state as being kind of a player in a kind of competitive marketplace of states, was really at the heart of Estonian digital policy in the 2010s, right? Like there's this e-residency
Totally.
program that was essentially designed with this idea in mind and sold directly to the tech sector.
And the guy who started that is on the board of Prospera in Honduras. But no, I mean, Estonia is a great example, right? Because this idea that they were able to, you were able to, get some degree of devolved power from Moscow originally by saying, you know, we're not trying to build up a freestanding democratic republic, but we're turning ourselves into a special economic zone, I think is a perfect example of how in the 90s, commodity became kind of, or sovereignty became commodified. And this idea of a brave new world of a shopping mall of jurisdictions really, you know, became the basis for, I think, a lot of the libertarian state co-optation we're seeing now.
Yeah, exactly.
Took us when I hit the ground. End up like a dog that's been beat too much till you spend half your
So to return to the foreign policy question, I was trying to think through how does this tech fascination with the zone or with sort of co-opting the state to create favorable economic conditions for oneself, how does that fit into this current foreign policy moment? And in some ways, you can really see that, I think, when Trump talks about turning Gaza into a U.S. occupied Riviera that sort of exists outside of the framework of sort of quote unquote normal international relations. And I think there is a degree of this also in the way that he's talking about Ukraine and signing away its rights to minerals in exchange for, so it really is putting foreign policy in the service of specific economic interests. And then in other cases it seems to kind of crash into the neoconservative, paleoconservative vision in which economic policy is really in some way subordinated to foreign policy.
What would be an example of that?
I mean, I think the well, the tariff policy is sort of one of them, I think.
I think that there's a real primacy of economic policy right now, actually. So I think this is where, being historians, we're in a better position to understand some of this than people who aren't, because a lot of what is happening looks to me a lot like the 19th century. The what sometimes is even called concession empire in that period meant that to take over, quote unquote, an area wasn't necessarily to annex it and make directly administer it as if it were part of the mother country. So when there's discussion of taking over Greenland or Panama, I think people naively assume that means that these will become, 51st and 52nd states. But the history of empire shows us that there's many more things on the menu besides just, being absorbed into the homogeneous blob of the metropole, and that actually empire works more often through diversity rather than sameness. And the interplay of private and public interest becomes really important there. I think the way that things have already been provisionally settled in Panama is a really good illustration of this. The Hong Kong, huge shipping conglomerate Hutchison, owned by Li Ka-shing, the richest man in Hong Kong, has been what looks like compelled to sell their management of the Panama Canal to BlackRock, the huge American asset manager. And since that deal has been floated and is likely to go through, we hear nothing anymore about the occupation or annexation of Panama. In other words, what began as something like very strange as a colonization project turns out as a kind of more run-of-the-mill business deal in which a Chinese affiliated company is now displaced by an American company. And the Ukraine minerals deal that you mentioned is, again, has echoes to me of England and Egypt in 1882, where effectively, because of some problem of conflict or mismanagement, a larger power comes in and overtakes this role of stewardship, and extracts extreme concessions through that, but also divests itself of a lot of the basic obligations of protecting citizenship or providing for the population or even necessarily security. So it's really classic 19th century style of gunboat diplomacy, bullying. And I would predict that something halfway point like that will be found in Greenland and perhaps Canada too, where uneven treaties will allow for, or what the Chinese called unequal treaties will allow for, sweetheart deals for American satellite downlink station operators or, rare earth mining companies in the north of Greenland, port operators, which then, when satisfied, will lift this demand for outright colonization.
Yeah, that's a pretty compelling framework, I think. Another issue where I think foreign policy and U.S. domestic policy have been kept somewhat separate in analysis, but I think could use with some closer integration is the way in which the U.S. administration has been, and I think quite explicitly for a long time, has been learning from the experience of far-right conservative leaders abroad, right? So the particular examples that are often cited are Hungary and
Poland.
Argentina. Right, the strategies that Viktor Orban used to stifle civil dissent in Hungary, in particular the assault on universities, and what's happening in the U.S. right now, and then Javier Milei's attack on state bureaucracy, which again is being played out in the U.S. In ways that are quite directly referencing him, right, with Elon Musk wielding a chainsaw.
Handed to him by Mila.
Exactly. Do you want to open that box a little bit? Because, it does, like, there is a sort of long history of the American neo-reactionaries looking towards people like Orban for inspiration or
Yeah,
for strategies.
I think the two are different in some ways as well, though. And I think partially one of the errors in this case of trying to import Milei's strategy is that Argentina is in a quite different place in the world economic system than the United States is, right? And there are people on the even the center part of the spectrum who are grudgingly applauding some of the things that Milei is doing. This is not obviously a position I would take, but there one can make the argument that there were structural economic problems in Argentina that have been really persistent from decade to decade, and that he, through draconian means, they think has come closer to solving these problems and making Argentina more creditworthy, et cetera. He's obviously also been targeting what he sees as political enemies in the process by specifically gutting cultural institutions and targeting universities, targeting the right to protest, targeting women's groups, as is often the case with these cycles of far right politics. This emerged in part out of as a counter reaction to a very successful mobilization in Argentina of women against the very restrictive abortion laws of Argentina, which then created a reservoir of resentment and misogynistic anger against women, which was then helped fuel Milei's momentum for his own like-minded supporters. So there's a cultural aspect to it, but it does seem to be mostly a kind of fiscal cleaning of the Augean stables that the United States simply does not share the same quandary with. So when Musk, and I think Musk does look to Milei as a prototype for what needs to be done in the United States government, he misrecognizes what is not a comparable entity at all. I mean, the Argentine state is not the American state. The American government has issues the world's reserve currency and has an extraordinary amount of latitude in the economic actions they take, up to the point that they're trying to push things now with such a disruptive tariff strategy that people are starting to think twice about their confidence in American debt and other historically very safe investment vehicles. But Musk misrepresenting America as Argentina, misrecognizing America as Argentina, I think is, leading him down a path of self-destruction and destruction for the many people that rely on the employment of the United States, the provisioning qualities and welfare provision of the United States government. We're only going to find out in coming weeks and months what the effect of trying to rapidly change the entire programming language of the federal government is going to have as repercussions of being able to perform basic functions. So that seems like this wild austerity, maximalism that will, certainly pan out with unexpected consequences. By contrast, I think the cultural war borrowed from really Hungary and Poland, as you suggest, is, I'm afraid to say, more likely to be successful.
Yeah.
I think there is a credible target there, and there are credible levers that can be used to disable the functioning of what they see, in some ways correctly, as some of the primary institutions that reproduce a certain set of elites, a certain set of opinions, a certain set of politics, cultural outlets to allow dissent to be heard or read in this country. It's actually, as people who organize bombing campaigns say, there are a lot of good targets. And what they've been doing so far to use exemplary action against some of the top Ivy institutions, Columbia in particular, followed closely by Harvard, to discipline the others and force a kind of preemptive obedience and internal purges of what are seen as deviant beliefs and diversity and principles of social justice is so far, I would say it's working. I mean, I would say that what they're trying to do, they're achieving, which is to create a sense of discipline and dismay and demoralization across the landscape of higher education. And through the choke points of federal funding around specifically USAID, which basically single-handedly funds all schools of public health in the United States until recently, NIH, National Institutes of Health funding, and Health and Human Services funding, which without which it's very hard to imagine most medical schools functioning in the United States, means that the budgets of all universities are going to be, all universities that don't just finance themselves through tuition dollars and don't do any kind of research, let's say all research universities are going to be massively disrupted in the next 6 to 12 months. And I am sure that no president in the country, no university president, has any idea how they're actually going to deal with this. There's no clear way to deal with it. So what's been done in Hungary and Poland to destroy independent academic inquiry and then also take over the commanding heights of cultural institutions like museums and archives and research institutes is underway. I mean, it's underway at the Smithsonian and it will be underway elsewhere. And that probably will too be possible to achieve their desires. So I think it's hard to transform the American state. I think it's hard to transform the American manufacturing base. I think it would, in by comparison, be relatively easy to gut the ecologies of free inquiry and free expression.
Yeah. I wish I could say I disagree. I wanted to play this in the other direction a little bit as well and think about the impact of the American far right government on the global far right, and I think and you're on the European far right in particular, because I think here this particular combination that you outline, right, this the culture wars plus maximalist austerity plus 19th century imperialist politics, I think caught quite a few people across the political spectrum, but particularly on the European far right a little bit by surprise, because the European far right is perfectly happy to sign on to the culture wars agenda. And you know, as we talked about, it's sort of co-constructed in a lot of ways. But the maximalist austerity and the imperialist politics, I think the European far right has quite some different, you know, quite complicated views about. A lot of the European far right pursues, and you know, Poland and Hungary are good examples of that, pursue a policy of actually building up the welfare state just for a specific set of
Recipients,
people.
yep, sure.
Exactly. And of course, being caught in the middle of superpowers creating zones of influence is something that, you know, for instance, in the Estonian case has completely fractured the far right, who, you know, has been historically quite Trumpy up until now, when they realize that the zones of influence politics actually leaves them on the wrong side, in the
Right.
wrong zone of influence.
Yeah, and this happened in Canada with the Conservative Party as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. I think that the way that MAGA 2.0 is developing is indeed at odds with most of the way that the European far right has been trending in the last decade, because I think you can take Meloni as a perfect representative right now. I would say she's the leading figure on the far right
Yeah, absolutely.
in Europe right now, especially considering today's verdict on Le Pen, which looks like has taken her out of contention as a political leader for the foreseeable future. But you know, since Brexit, we had a small wave of other exits being floated, but it didn't take too long for the far right to wisely realized that they could get more out of Brussels by staying in the EU than they could by getting out of it. And that, in fact, rather than split from the EU, they could just take it over. And that, I think, has been a really effective strategy for them. I think that the fact that Orban has done what he's done and still, despite having some, you know, transfer funds or whatever suspended, is still, you know, respectable member of the EU shows you how far you can actually go without experiencing any real consequences. And then meanwhile, he's been able to play things both ways by welcoming in Chinese investment and Korean investment in one direction, remaining relatively close to Russia, despite sanctions, opening up special economic zones, despite those aren't really being allowed by European economic policy. So yeah, the European far right was smart to think that they didn't need to do a kind of war of movement. They could just do kind of a war or a war of maneuver. They could just do a slow kind of trench warfare over time, clean out the cultural obstacles internally, remain connected, create this sort of reactionary international model, which was working for their side, I would say. The MAGA 2.0 is so disruptive and unpredictable and anti-incumbent institutional in ways that it really only represents, it only reflects one similarity, which is Putin invading Ukraine in 2022. I mean, that's who it looks most like, right? I mean, it's much less like, you name it, Bolsonaro, China, anyone else, certainly the British conservatives, and it's much more like that action that is almost designed to shatter your preconceptions of what normal behavior by states ought to be or are even. So that willingness, and I don't think that's coincidental, right? I think that Putin and Russia have set a certain bar for what it looks like to exercise real power and sovereignty in defiance of global norms and still succeed, because they kind of have, that has been inspirational to parts of the American right, for sure. And what that does to all the people left in the shatterlands in between, whether it's Estonia or China or Canada, is seemingly just collateral damage they're indifferent to. So what the European far right does in response, I think, is going to be interesting to watch. I mean, so far, someone like Meloni is just trying to play it both ways, to have meetings with Musk about, introducing Starlink, but then also interested in big investment projects that could benefit, Italian manufacturing instead. Going along board with the idea of ending the war in Ukraine, but then also wanting to make sure it's not on overly asymmetrical terms. So I think it galls me to say it, but like many people on the European far right are kind of acting like more responsible statespeople than someone like the American cabinet is right now, which is really mostly acting like chaos agents without a real sense of what the long-term strategy is. It's just I it's almost painful to have these kind of frank overviews of the present moment where you're just like, what is going on?
Yeah, absolutely.
Alas pidime, kuid enam mina neiukest suudlema ei lähe.